Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. Bam! Welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining us in about 15 minutes will be my good friend, fellow Rhino, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air. But now, let me bring on our token conservative. J.R. Dunn of America's Acre.
How are you?
J.R., how's it going, buddy?
Ooh. So what's on the agenda? What's on the agenda?
Oh,
we talking
I don't
about
know
the
what's
riots
going on in the world. Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, amazing. We'll get to that, but I want to talk to you a little bit about gay marriage, because Supreme Court heard arguments today, oral arguments, and it's actually, they have a choice. They don't have to make gay marriage the law of the land. They can rule very, very narrowly, you know. And I think you're an attorney. Did I accuse you of being an attorney earlier and you're not, or you are an attorney, right?
No, I'm not an attorney. I've been in business, I've been in arts, I've been in a number of things. Right now,
right.
I'm just a humble editor, that's all.
Oh, okay. Humble. Right. Okay.
So to speak.
But I'm thinking, I'm no lawyer, but I've been reading a lot about what the Supreme Court does for many years. And my take is they might chicken out and rule very narrowly in this case and not give the gay activists the big victory they're looking for. I'm just wondering if you have any sense from what you've read today whether that's a possibility or not.
I think that's the only way they can play it, actually. If they don't want to cause complete chaos and complete contempt from all ends of the compass, it appears that Kennedy is beginning to become very. It has shown himself to be very skeptical of the entire argument, and he of course is a swing vote. We got the four votes from the Roberts section of the court, which we can take for granted are going to be vote against gay marriage, and we got the four liberals. Though extraordinarily enough, Stephen Breyer has also proven to be very skeptical about it, which really struck me. So I don't think I would say offhand who wants to predict. I mean, look what happened with Obamacare.
Right.
But I would think
John Roberts might be the swing. If Kennedy refuses to vote for universal gay marriage, John Roberts might be your man. He might be your man.
Roberts is a practicing Catholic, so that I think takes that right off the table.
Yeah, except he has a penchant for wanting to write historic opinions. And
that's true, but in that case you can go either way. And I don't think he wants to put himself up as a Catholic that voted in favor of the gays, particularly since how anti-Catholic the entire gay movement is. One of their major targets, of course, is the Catholic Church. And
yes.
but here's the thing: the way that the vote should go, and the way that I see it, is that it should be left to the states.
Be left to state legislatures.
Absolutely, state legislatures. They should overturn these court cases. Let's face it: these court cases were driven by liberal activism. The first judge, I forget her name, but the first judge in Massachusetts that found a gay marriage legal was the husband of what's his name, Gideon's Trumpet, Anthony.
Right. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, he's the ultra liberal. I don't think he's quite leftist, but he's the ultra liberal legal expert for the New York Times for about 30 years.
Yeah.
So we know exactly what happened here. We know exactly what went down at the dinner table when he and her honor were discussing it. And that's where it's come from. We got the guy in California that made it turns out to be a gay man who immediately ran out and married his partner. So this is obviously an attempt by gays to ramrod their agenda through the court system. It's a form of lawfare, and it is to my mind, incumbent upon the Supreme Court to put an end to it, just in order
to keep
a sense of legitimacy to the judicial system. And if you turn it back to the state legislature, then
social conservative. I am not a social conservative. Good.
I am, as you well know, in many ways. I'm not completely a social conservative. I mean, you know, I'm an old rock and roller. How can I be?
When you're talking about a cultural change, it's a cultural tsunami.
A cultural earthquake. Yeah, you betcha.
The only way it can be accepted. I mean, you know, you're not going
to
jam this down people's throats. The only way it can be accepted is through the legislatures of the states acting at the advice of their constituents.
Right.
You know, yeah. So what if it takes 10 more years? They can't wait 10 frickin' whacking years? I mean,
well, I think it's at a point. I think they're trying to tear off as much as they can while they're on top, once again, so to speak. But because, let's face it, the situation now is so unstable, it's not going to last. The closet door may well swing shut once people get a whiff of their current agenda. The current thing is run by women who basically want to be nice to their hairdressers. Women in office and women in business have and these are straight women, not gay women, not lesbians. These are straight women have been pushing this agenda and basically badgering straight males and their husbands in order to make life easier for the gays because they feel sorry for them. Now, once these women get it clear in their heads that part of the entire gay movement is child abuse, then that slams shut. And they have no allies in the straight world anymore, and that is when things are going to start to turn. We haven't seen anything of this yet, but that's what's going to happen. So they have to try to get this thing in place and legally, have it legally on legal bedrock before things turn around. That's my thesis anyway.
Well, I don't know if it's going to turn around. I mean, this is the thing here, JR.
It's going to an extreme. It's an extreme. This is a minuscule part of the national.
Not when 55% of the country agrees with gay marriage. It's not an extreme.
Neither is
opposing gay marriage. Neither is opposing gay marriage a fringe issue, which the gay activists try to make it out so. It's not. It's
a central issue.
Mainstream to oppose gay marriage. And that's why it has to go to the states. But let me tell you why this is. We're at a point of no return.
I don't buy those polls. By the way, polls only mean anything when it has to do with somebody personally. People look
when
upon this as
every single
as being
one of them. Yeah, personally. Okay, that's a great intro for my point. Over the last decade or more, as more and more gay people come out to their families, to their friends, to their coworkers, to their relatives. People begin to see that gay people are not child molesters, as you tried to bring up there. Very small.
Many
percentage
of them are.
Probably about the same percentage as heterosexual men.
Yes,
That's not the point.
They're much more active.
The point is,
Rick, stop right
that
now.
They
they're
are
much,
now
they're much more
gaining
active.
Acceptance. They are gaining acceptance. And as they gain acceptance, people can't see why they shouldn't be able to marry. That's why this is a downhill issue for gay activists, which they should have recognized and gone after, done the hard, slogging scut work necessary to change the hearts and minds of people at the state levels so that they can win in the legislature. Yeah, so Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, maybe Oklahoma, maybe those states don't have gay marriage for 10, 15 years? But eventually they will. They would have.
It's not that simple. Rick, I used to live in the West Village. for a good long period of time. There's nothing anybody can tell me about gays. I have seen it all. And that's the entire point. When you find out what the gay lifestyle is like, when you find out the way a lot of these people live and the miserable circumstances and the really shocking behavior and attitude towards straights, because they despise and loathe straights. They want to hurt them really, real badly. When you discover that, you tend to turn on them. I have nothing against them. I have nothing against any of them personally. But I do have something against their politics because I know what's behind it because I used to hear it every day. When I was living in the village, people used to take me as often as being gay, all right? Even though it wasn't even, I used to wear leather jackets all every place. Well, but it wasn't gay leather. They didn't notice it wasn't gay leather. It was punk rock leather because that's what I was into at the time. But they would sit around talking about what they wanted to do with the breeders and how the breeders had to be straightened out and this, that, and another thing. You'd hear it from all of them. And this is not what you hear when they're walking around waving in their rainbow flags with simpering smirks on their faces. And this is going to come out. This is going to emerge. The actual agenda that they have is going to emerge, and it's not very nice, it's not very pleasant, and people are not going to stand for it.
Well, you're talking about gays in the East Village. This is a country of 300 million people.
But the agenda is the same all across the country. They are your next door neighbor
who might still be in the closet. They are your construction worker who's gay, who's out to his coworker.
No, Rick, there aren't many gay construction workers.
You want to bet? You want to bet?
There aren't. When you're talking about construction workers in the game below, that's a very small percentage. That's a minuscule percentage of a minuscule percentage.
Well, they're
not all
hairdressers, and they're not all scoutmasters. I mean, come on.
I'll give you a few antique store owners.
You're stereotyping.
Bed and breakfast operators. Yeah, a few of those, sure.
Good. And there are straight ones, too, right? I mean, my point is very simple. You can't tell a gay person by looking at them, even talking to them. So, I can.
Rick, I used to live in the West Village. I have a very highly developed gaydar. My gaydar is like the international, the intercontinental ballistic missile warning system.
Right. Okay. We'll stick you in Alaska. That way you'll give us early warning. Okay. Let's bring on Jazz. Start talking. I think I've had enough of gay talk.
Let's get away from this.
Joining us now, my good friend and compadre, Jazz Shaw on air. Jazz, welcome.
Thank you. I'm afraid I dialed into the wrong show after I heard all the stuff about the gay construction workers. I realized I was unprepared to discuss the Village People. I used to have all their albums, but I'm really not up to, on what they're up to
These
days.
Yeah, well,
that
was a poor example. Just flew out of my head. What can I say? The gays are football players. How's that?
Yeah. One of them who didn't make the cut.
Yeah, he never. Yeah, there are others. I'll guarantee you, there are others. There are baseball players.
Indian Chiefs. Yeah, true.
So you had the construction worker, the Indian chief. Who else was a Village beat? The cop, yeah, that's right. You got cops
in there,
too. Okay. YMCA, okay.
I knew somebody was going to bring that up.
Let's get serious, because this is an extremely serious subject. What we witnessed yesterday afternoon and last night were images that we have not seen probably since the Rodney King riots in 1991. And, it was not as bad as the long, hot summers of 67 and 68. But
very
I'm wondering if it won't get that way. Yeah, I'm wondering if it won't get that way. The reason that those summers were bad was because it wasn't just one city. It was a dozen or two dozen.
Right.
And it wasn't just big cities. It was medium-sized cities. It was anywhere that you had you know, a lot of frustration built up. Jazz, I'm going to put this right to you out of the gate. Sorry to not let you warm up or anything. What are the chances of these protests? And you know it's going to happen again. You know, some poor criminal is going to get you know, caught up with the police and get killed. So we're going to have more of these. What are the chances of one of these incidents igniting a firestorm that sweeps the country and then we are at like 67 and 68?
I guess I'm still too much of an optimist. I would say that chances are relatively low. Everything, there's a tinderbox in every major city. Every large urban population center with a heavy minority presence is upset about the stuff they've seen on the news in other places. Some of them have their own complaints with their local police forces, a level of how much those complaints are justified. I leave that up to the observer. In some cases, there are clearly individual incidents where people have a right to complain because there's some messed up things that have happened. A lot of other times, not so much. But if it stays at individual city level and then fades away, I mean, look at the pattern we're seeing. There were huge marches, which never turned into too much mass, you know, burning and stuff like that in New York, in Staten Island.
Yes.
The stuff in Ferguson was bad. So, you know, many buildings burned and looted, and there were a lot of injuries. Lasted for a while, but that's mostly dropped back down to a little above normal noise level. Baltimore, I just think the potential was there in Baltimore from the beginning. If anybody ever watched the television series The Wire on HBO,
The Wire, yeah.
I've heard that described many times with no joke, what no humor intended at all, that it was more of a documentary than a drama.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really is a picture of inner city Baltimore. The violent crime rate there is insane. It's like four times above the national average. The unemployment rate in somebody was just reporting on this yesterday at the Atlantic. I was reading it in West Baltimore. The overall unemployment rate, when the rest of the country has dropped down into 5 point something, 6 point something, still almost 19.7. And the minority unemployment rate in that area is over 33. And it's a bad place with a lot of very organized criminal activity. They've got every gang you could imagine represented there. I would not want to have to be one of the residents. I can't imagine life is very great for them. I would not want to be one of the cops. That's a horribly difficult place to police. You know?
Yes.
And what happened to Freddie Gray, we still don't know. That's the problem. We don't have any answers. Another report came out this afternoon saying they had found a medical report from an emergency room that he had injured his spine a week before the arrest. So if that turns out to be true, is that a game changer? I was just saying on Twitter a little while ago, I think that ship's already sailed. Even if it turns out to be something other than what it looked like, there were still mistakes made, people are upset, and he has now become a totem, as opposed to an individual crime story, however improperly he may have been treated. So I guess to wrap that up and answer your question, Rick, I'm hopeful that it doesn't turn into a 1968-style national conflagration, but you're going to see more of these. You absolutely are.
Yeah. J.R., the police, Baltimore is a grimy city. It is the grimiest city on the East Coast. I don't know. I spent a lot of time.
It's not quite as grimy as Newark.
Pre-New Renaissance, you know, when they built all the center city, what that did was, of course, hollow out all the neighborhoods around it. Just hollowed them out, which exacerbated the problem. Same thing happened in Detroit when they built the Renaissance Center, and the same thing happened with the neighborhood surrounding the project. But here we have a black majority city, run by a black mayor, several
black council,
black city council, black police chief,
uh-huh.
black fire chief.
It blows up.
And the city blows up astronomically. Now,
blows up anyway. Yeah.
I wanted to get in detail about the incompetence of these people, and specifically the mayor.
Absolutely.
But for the moment, what I want to know from you is, given that we don't know what happened to this Mr. Gray.
But we do know what happened to, well, we do know what happened to, what's
set.
His name?
The narrative is set, isn't it? No matter
we do
what
know what happened
say,
to Walter Scott, though.
He died in a chokehold, obviously. He was killed by white cops, obviously. Even though we don't know which cops were involved, we don't know what happened in that police van. Period. You know, we just don't know. It doesn't matter because the narrative has been set, just like Ferguson. Stop, you know, stop, don't shoot, whatever. Isn't that true? What are the chances that even if the truth comes out and this is it is not the police's fault, what are the chances that the narrative will change?
I don't see how we get from what seems to have happened to it's not the police's fault. I don't even begin to see it. I think those sons of bitches killed that poor guy. I think they beat him
yeah.
to death. And I think there's no two ways around it. We don't know exactly what happened to Gray, but we know exactly what happened to Walter Scott down in SC. He got shot in the back
yeah.
eight times.
Yeah,
what we've
yeah.
got,
that was
what we got here, is a confrontation between two completely pathological and dysfunctional subcultures in this country: police forces and inner city ghettos. They are totally off the wall. They are totally nuts. They virtually deteriorated into criminal organizations. What we have got with the cops is the fact that sociopaths. I'm talking murderous psychopaths. They tend to find their way to these organizations, okay? And they're protected by the blue wall of silence because they're brothers, all right? And they get away with murder. They do it constantly for years. They actually get assignments in these neighborhoods, in the slums, the black slums, because they can get away with it. They can get away with brutalizing, beating people, ripping people off, every other kind of thing. And they are protected by the police forces all the way up and down. Now, when I was living in New Brunswick about 10, 12 years ago, there was a guy named Craterface who was notorious for beating suspects and even molesting passersby. Just everybody, white, black, didn't matter. And if you went across the river in Piscataway, there was another one. His name I forget, but he was one of the black glove cops. He's one of the ones who wear black driving gloves and works out, so he's super muscular and wears those Android sunglasses. So you can't see expression in his eyes. His thing was stopping motorists from out of town and terrorizing them.
I know.
So if you're driving anywhere through Central Jersey, what's that?
I'm sorry. I'm just wondering. Don't you think you're painting cops with a pretty broad brush here? I mean,
I'm not saying all cops are psychos. I was just getting to that. I am saying that damn well near every police force in this country has people like this in it, and there is no attempt whatsoever to ease them out. What they do instead is stick them where there's not going to be much oversight. Stick them where people are not going to look, and people are not going to complain, and they're not going to pay any attention to the complaints when they come. Okay, and where is that?
Yeah.
We ask.
Yeah.
They're going to stick them
yeah.
into the slums. You're damn well right. So you have constant confrontations between these deranged cops who should not even been allowed to get near a uniform and legally carry a gun and a sidearm or rather a nightstick, a taser, and all the rest, and use them whenever they please, and the criminal element in the black neighborhoods. And everybody
yeah.
else is caught in the middle. And now we're seeing things come to a head. We're seeing the final explosion. So what we need to do first is, well, obviously gain order in these areas. And I don't think it's going to blow up this summer in the rest of the cities, because let's face it, Mayor Blake is a complete lulu. She's just complete incompetent.
Listen, we'll get to
okay,
her.
Okay,
we'll
and,
get to her. I promise. Next, we'll
right.
get to her. But Jazz,
right.
do you buy JR's argument?
No, obviously I don't. There are individual cases where some of the phenomena that he's describing absolutely are true. By and large, and trust me, I have plenty of cops in my family, and I know quite a few of them, and I lived in Jersey for quite a while myself, too, by the way. So, yeah, I find a generalization like that, although I don't think that's exactly what Jay was saying, but if someone did take that as a generalization about cops, I would not only find it wrong, but offensive. The vast majority of cops are, you know, doing a tough job and doing the best they can. They are also, human beings, and you're going to get sometimes that probably are just every bit as bad as he's saying, but clearly more the exception than the rule. I do believe that, however, police forces both rise to the level of excellence of the community that they're serving and can devolve to levels that we would not like to think are happening if they are in a, pardon my use of the phrase, a devolved community. And if you have cops that are in, like, an area where I live, it's a primarily white, suburban area, middle class and upwards, you know, you never see problems like this. And our cops are very laid-back, donut-eating people who, you know, pretty much don't bother anybody. But if you get assigned as a police officer to one of these forces, as Jared was describing, Baltimore being an excellent example, no, there's no excuse when somebody gets out of control, when somebody is out there, you know, shooting somebody in the back eight times like we saw in South Carolina, completely inexcusable. That's a rogue cop, in my opinion. But the whole police force, if you're out there every day in a place like Brownsville in New York, in a place like West Baltimore, in a place like Camden, New Jersey, you are facing an environment that is not a normal environment to most of us. The vast majority of people that you're looking at, not saying the vast majority are criminals, but they probably distrust you, don't think much of the law to start with. There is no that image from the 1940s of the happy cop walking down the walk on his beat, you know, twirling his baton and whistling and saying hi to Mrs. Jones. You're not going to see that in a really crime-infested area like Brownsville.
You don't see that anyplace.
It's a war zone, you know. And the cops respond to the environment that they're in. That's my point. So you're going to see a different style of policing, which is going to be pushing close to the line all the time. And sometimes it's going to go over the line, and that fosters more resentment on the other side, not just amongst criminals, but the rest of the community at large, who may feel, you know, hey, you're just out, you're not serving and protecting, you're just out to get us. So I think the situation breaks down. I'd love to finish this up with my solution of, and here's how you fix that. I have no clue.
Me neither. And of course, we see the same thing in Chicago. You got that, they had a secret jail, a secret location where they
right.
would bring suspects to work over. I mean, it's just this kind of thing.
And who do they have
One thing I buy from your argument, JR, is that if you get a cop with several complaints against them from suspects,
you put him in your super jail.
I can see them putting him in an area that, like you said, people would not go to the police and complain about it.
You know, the white guy who's an executive in the insurance company, if he gets stopped by one of these guys and worked over, you're going to hear about it. If he stops the guy, on the other hand, the black working man who has an old pot conviction, nobody's going to hear about it.
Yeah.
That's my argument. That is obviously a factor in the two cases we're talking about here. Not Derek Wilson, all right? Derek Wilson did his job and intelligently backed off, resigned his position as a cop, and kept his mouth shut and let things play out. Derek Wilson, there's no question he's a decent human being, and he would make a great cop in any town on the face of the earth, though obviously he's never going to get another job in a police force.
Unless he changes his name. But
we're talking about the guy in Augusta, South Carolina, and we're talking about these cops in Baltimore. I will bet anybody 10 to 1 that is what we're talking about. We're talking about the black glove cops. We're talking about cops who are just in there to brutalize people and we'll work them over and get away with whatever they can get away with.
Yeah. Well, let's move
and that's
on.
My contention is to get to my ultimate point here, this is being played as a black-white thing. It's not a black-white thing. It's a pathological culture thing, which is affecting everybody. This does affect white people. These people do operate in working class areas. This guy Craterface, New Brunswick is a working-class town, except for the college area around Rutgers. New Brunswick is a working-class town, and that is why Crater Face was allowed to get away with it, was allowed to beat people until they spent 6 months in the hospital on a more or less regular basis. From my understanding, I never had any run-ins with him. But I talked to a lot of people who did have run-ins with this guy, and I talked to somebody who directly had a run-in with a guy in Piscataway. He was trying to get to the hospital with his child who had badly injured in an accident, and this SOB stopped his car and did a vehicle inspection on the street while a kid was bleeding and sobbing in the back seat.
Boy.
That's what people deal with every day in this country with police forces, and that is because of the police the subculture has been allowed to deteriorate. I don't think there's any question about that.
It's evolved separately. I think part of the problem.
Yes, absolutely.
It's evolved
in isolation. It's been deliberately isolated from the citizens, as Chas mentioned. Yeah. It's not the 1940s anymore with Officer Smith giving apples to the kids. That doesn't happen.
No. Well, Chas, let's move on because this is an incredible incompetency by the city officials.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're talking about a mayor here who on Saturday actually gave permission to rioters to go ahead and destroy stuff. She said, "We also gave those who wish to destroy space to do that as well."
I'm asking Jazz, JR.
You'll get
right,
your turn.
Right, but,
everybody wants to jump in on this thing because it's so juicy. But I'm trying to think of remember the Kerner Commission? Otto Kerner, former Illinois governor, who headed up a commission after the riots in the 60s and recommended basically that we buy off the black community with the Great Society.
That worked.
And that's pretty much what we did. But in that Kerner Commission was a report on the police. And basically, they made the point that the police fed those riots, Jazz, by their reactions to the rioters. So that now you have the second generation forward of blacks now in charge of the city, now in charge of the police department, who want to do it a little differently. And so they come up with this idea that we should let people let off a little steam, as I think David Dinkins said back in the 90s, let off a little steam, and then we can take control after. Well, that didn't quite work out there, did it, Jazz?
No, but if we're going to discuss the incompetence of the mayor of Baltimore, and to a certain extent, certainly also the police chief, in handling this situation, were mistakes made in terms of should have known this was coming and obviously did know and said they could tell something like this was coming and were just grossly unprepared for it. Yeah, they were horrible mistakes made. They were not ready for this. The response was botched. And then they may be going overboard in the other direction right now with 200 National Guard troops walking around. Some of the footage that was just showing for the last hour that I was watching before the show is pretty alarming. I'm very nervous, to say the least, what's going to happen come 10 o'clock when the curfew is supposed to start, because I don't see people looking like they're getting ready to leave. So let's see how they respond this time, how the community responds. But as I started to say, yeah, that's one level of incompetence. Things that happened since Freddie Gray died. There's been a lot of mistakes made. But on the other hand, I think there is endemic incompetence that's been going on for a long time that allowed the situation to get to this juncture. And that's a perhaps easier problem to address once these horrible events, sort of shine a light on that. And then everybody has to reel it back in once things start to settle back down and say, okay, how do we not let it get to that point again? And the police definitely have to have a new approach. They need to work with somebody that knows what they're doing to figure out how to diffuse things better, how to get a little bit of improvement in community relations so there isn't that battle lines immediately ready to be drawn. But at the same time, how does this problem get solved, Rick, unless they figure out how to get Baltimore's crime problem under control? Because we can't just make saints out of all these people in the streets when a bunch of them are Crips and Bloods and the New Muslim Brotherhood and whoever else, and they just have these skyrocketing and, you know, just perpetually high levels of violent crime. And the cops can't ignore that. You can't say, well, I guess we'll close up shop and let them burn the place down. That doesn't work. So there's been incompetence for a long time, both in effective law enforcement and effective community relations and letting things get out of control, so that when this happened, it was just so ready to go up like a bonfire. So that's the incompetence that we should be looking at. The mayor's been there 5 years now. Lots of could have been changed during her tenure to make things not quite this bad. And those things weren't done. Somebody's got to be held accountable, and they got to put some changes in place. But first, they have to survive the next few nights.
Yeah, that'll be problematic. JR, this is a brand new way to approach civil unrest. I got to give it to her.
I don't think it is. No, I think it's standard. I think there's way too much being read into her statement there. It's obvious to me that she misspoke, that she ran several different thoughts together without and just spoke without thinking. Instead, I don't think she was saying, well, I gave them space and it was to destroy. She was trying to say something like, I wanted to give the crowd a little space so they could express themselves, but they went out and destroyed things. I mean, let's face it. She's a Democratic East Coast big city mayor. She is dumb as a post. She's in there because it was her turn. Okay?
Yeah.
And you can't expect her to express herself very well.
She came. She was elevated to the post of mayor when the former mayor went to jail for corruption.
There you go. There you go.
Then she won her.
Then
she won
somebody else will be put in.
Yeah.
But the point is it's the standard liberal take of, you know, let the little people run around and jump up and down and make some noise in order to let them work off some steam. Then after that, it'll be back to business as usual. That was her attitude. Unfortunately, as Jess says, you throw in a New Muslim Brotherhood and the Crips and you got a problem. Okay? Now, This is why I don't think that that there's going to be a big explosion this summer, because I don't think most of the mayors are quite that flaky. I don't think they're that incompetent. Some of them, yeah, and there may be problems in their towns, but not all of them. And by the way, I would like to put in a good word for Larry Hogan. I don't think he overreacted at all. The most important thing about these riots is that you have to restore order immediately. You have to do it as soon as possible, which is what Blake didn't do. And Larry Hogan, he got the troops in right away. This, you know, what I was thinking today was, Jesus, it's lucky they had a Republican in there. If this had happened last year, it would have been like the apocalypse.
Probably, yeah.
There's a story from 1968 about this, as a matter of fact. It was while the rest of the country was blowing up, a riot started in Cincinnati, and the police chief, whose name I forget, I can't remember, he was driving around just keeping an eye on things, right? And he got a call from one of his cars, and they're saying, we have a number of people in the black neighborhood who are starting to smash windows and throw garbage cans in the street, and it looks like a riot is developing. Should we observe? And the police chief immediately got on the phone and said, you will not observe. You will meet illegal force with legal force. And he immediately got every cop in the city down there and got them smashing heads. And there was no riot in Cincinnati.
Yeah,
virtually
smashed heads
among the big cities in the Midwest and the East Coast.
Yeah.
Well, as we were saying, we're talking about Muslim Brotherhood and Crips. So who cares?
If I could have one brief comment about Larry Hogan, because he brought that up. Unfortunate aspect of this that feeds into it is the poor quality of the media coverage that we get, which gets spread out. It's just ubiquitous. And rich or poor, everybody these days, you know, they have access to the internet, they have access to cable on every device. And I watched somewhat with horror earlier, when, of course, the Reverend Al Sharpton showed up down there. And the mayor has been in office, as I said earlier, for, 5 years now? Hogan has been in office for 90 days, and Sharpton found a way to blame Larry Hogan. And I was like, you know, at least spread it around a little. And it's like, the guy has barely unpacked his bags.
But he's white.
And that's not helpful. You know, it's not helpful.
Well, Maryland law makes it necessary for the local officials to call the governor, to ask the governor for the National Guard. He cannot just send the National Guard in there. He had to wait for Blake to ask him, which she
that
did
be arranged,
around 9:30 after 6 hours of absolute total chaos and mayhem.
That can be arranged. And I suspect it had something to do something. I suspect somebody from him, maybe he personally called up and said, "Don't you think it's about time, Lady Mayor, that we get some forces in there?"
Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly probably what happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right about Hogan. He was calm. He was cool. His statement
absolutely
struck exactly the right tone. Firm, but trying to be understanding of the peaceful protesters, of which we have to admit the vast majority of protesters who marched after the funeral were peaceful until they weren't.
True.
Okay. Then all hell broke loose.
But Al got to the important point. Larry Hogan's white.
Oh, yes.
He got to the important point.
And that brings up an interesting point, Jazz, about justification. And I want to direct, I hope you read this because it is one of the most shocking things I've read in quite a while. Ta-Nehisi Coates, writer for The Atlantic, he just wrote a book about the case for slave reparations. He's generally not too bad. I mean, he's generally a pretty level-headed guy, not a racialist in the sense that he views the entire world through the prism of race. But he wrote this article this morning that is just incredible, basically saying, and you know, he doesn't come out and say, but the takeaway, when nonviolence begins halfway through the war, with the aggressor calling time out, it exposes itself as a ruse. In other words, he's saying, but because our big cities are so awful to blacks, and you know the police departments are so awful to blacks, the fact that they're going out now in front of the entire world and asking for calm and peace is a ruse. They don't really mean it. Or if they do mean it, they don't deserve it. This was an incredible article, and I don't want to say that he came right out and tried to justify the violence, but he certainly gave an underpinning of approval.
I read that. He kind of circumnavigated the topic in order to give as much support as possible without being accused of instigating violence.
Very clever. Jazz, did you read that
article?
And
Salon, too. Salon was the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think, Jazz?
What's a Salon piece? Let me look at this.
I did. Well, he's looking at that. And I was a little bit less shocked only because it's a message that's already been repeated. I've seen people in the media and politicians, both state and federal level, and I could go and dig up some examples for you if you wanted, because I wrote about them last summer when things were really starting to get ginned up in Ferguson and there was violence. There were too many people writing, talking on television, coming to address the residents, coming to address the public, who would come in and say, they would start off with the obligatory, "Of course, we don't condone violence, and this needs to end." But then it always got couched at the end, not always, but so often, with little disclaimers like, "Though you can kind of understand why they're so upset and why they would be angry." And, well, you know, I possibly can understand why you'd be upset or why you'd be angry. That doesn't really explain why you're looting the Quickie Mart. You know, it doesn't explain why you set fire to the sewing machine factory. You know, and when you say, "Well, no, of course we don't disapprove of, we don't approve of this," but you can sort of understand. No, you just say, "We don't approve of violence." That period, full stop.
And
that's the
that,
end of the sentence. And they seem to feel obligated.
They're not walking into the liquor store screaming what's his name, Mr. Gray's name, and screaming police brutality. They're walking to the liquor store and screaming, "Pass me that Jimmy Beam," you know. they aren't protesting anything. How about, and that's another question. Every single reporter on every single network couched their opening for their segment in the idea of connecting the violence to the protests. The only connection is that the people were out there. The only connection is that the people were out there for the protest. It has nothing to do with the nature of the protest, what the protest was about. It has everything to do with mob violence, people getting together in mobs and tearing up the joint. I don't understand how they get away with that, but that's neither here nor there.
It's a very 60s thing. It's the unmentioned agenda here, which is why the left backs these people up. Okay, the idea here is it's in Marxism it's called increasing the contradictions. Okay, you just keep on pushing things and keep on using your little pawns to push things until your enemy collapses. And that's what they're doing here. They're using they're backing these people up, not because they give a damn about the blacks or they want to see the civil rights dream brought to fruition or any other kind of a thing. They're doing it in order to do as much damage to American society as they possibly can. So that's why they're basically instigating riots in print and supporting violence in order to this, that, and another thing. Like Benji Hart here, it's obviously not the dog, I don't know, but his headline is "Smashing Police Cars is a Legitimate Political Strategy." Well, Benji, I got news for you. If smashing police cars is a legitimate political strategy, then chasing people off the streets with shotguns is a political strategy as well, legitimate.
And smashing his car is a good political strategy. Well, you should just go smash his car.
Exactly. It's always said about one side. They were actually saying this back in the Cold War period. As if you're saying, well, the Soviet Union should have H bombs, but not the United States.
I wasn't smashing your car. I was making a statement.
They make a statement, exactly. Hey, Reverend Al, come on over here. You want to talk about this?
Jesus.
There's so much nonsense talked about American race in this country. There's so much fog and so much smoke and so much squid ink being scattered all over everything that you can't see through to the actual core topic. You can't even begin to get any idea what the solution might be. And it's deliberate. That's what people don't want to admit. It's deliberate. It really serves the agenda of some really nasty forces in this country, that being the far left.
You're absolutely right. When Eric Holder said early in the Obama administration that white people are cowards because they don't want to talk about race.
There you go.
What he really meant is that white people are cowards because they don't want to talk about the race the way I want to talk about it.
Because they don't agree with
because
they don't agree with the chinless wonder.
Exactly. They do not acknowledge, and by they I mean the racialists, the Eric Holders and Jesse Jacksons and Al Sharpton, they do not acknowledge there is a legitimate counter-argument to many of their public policy proposals. I'm not talking about human rights or civil rights.
Right.
I'm talking
about
EEOC and stuff like that. There is, if you don't agree with them on anti-discrimination law, you're a racist. And there's no way to discuss. Jazz,
there's no sense of compromise. There's no concept of negotiation.
I don't disagree with that at all. I can't help but sitting here and listening to you discuss it and the things that we're talking about, but wonder how we get to a point where people can identify that what we're looking at isn't, certainly in no way is this a case of individual cops or individual criminals. We're looking at a cultural problem in many, many places in the country. And yes, it's most prevalent, most common in urban areas that are very economically challenged, that have a variety of problems. When you reach a point in a segment of society in an area where it's just become not even the new normal, just the normal. It's just accepted life that people aren't going to have a good job, that crime is, you'll look the other way if you're not participating in it, because that's how it is around here, and that's the only way that some people can find to get by, that's, you know, the attitude. And so the cops are seen as a challenge, preventing people from doing things like that. It's a new culture. It's an acceptance of what should be a substandard life for anyone in the United States. But once it's been there for a couple of generations, now it's just baked into the cake. And as we discussed earlier, then you have a problem with how do the police deal with that environment on a day-to-day basis. You're not going to solve this problem unless the culture changes. And boy, that is a daunting task for anyone to look at.
Right, and the police can't change the culture. All they can do is deal with the effects of this dysfunctional culture that's out there.
That's not their job, no. And actually, the government can't. I'm sorry to say this.
Exactly.
Nobody can but the people themselves. If there isn't
people
change
themselves, yes.
From families, from schools, from churches, saying we're tired of this, and you know we're going to have a for the rule of law and try to give ourselves a chance and clean up our own streets, if it doesn't start there, you can't impose that from the outside.
That's why I was encouraging to see the mother slapping her son for
the Baltimore TV stations are saying she was child abuse. So anyway, I think it is child abuse when you hit your kid in the face. That's child abuse. But having said that, there is a case here to be made for this cultural change that Jazz is talking about being possible. If, one, the black family was intact, if, two, there was more involvement by churches. The gang culture is remarkably, remarkably resilient and remarkably attractive to so many black kids because it's a shortcut. You know, you don't have to go to school and learn stuff in order to get a good job, good paying job, and succeed in life. And play by the rules. You can get rich, or at least, you know, you'll have money in your pocket, change jangling in your pocket, if you join a gang and do illegal stuff. There is a way to change that. I mean, they've done it in some cities in Western Europe, where gangs were a huge problem, and the community had a combination of stuff by the police. By the government that did in fact, you know, alter the dynamic, if you will, that caused these kids to join the gangs. I don't know if America is not so attuned to that. Plus, you have the idea that when you have 20 or 30 people in the country screaming at you that the reason you're where you are is because of white racism, white supremacy, white privilege, you know, it's an easy thing to rely on that, to fall back on it, and refuse to do the things necessary to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and get out of poverty. Well, that silenced the crowd.
Well, just to extrapolate a little, what really worries me about this is if this increases, and it might, since there are some social forces working to antagonize this deliberately, as I talked about, you know, increasing the contradictions. If this increases, what the problem that we'll be facing is an extreme reaction. Now, the other thing that happened in 1968, and the riots played quite a large part in this, was the election of Richard M. Nixon.
Yes.
Not a good idea.
No.
Yeah, law and order platform, exactly. And there was a split in the vote between him and the great George Wallace, which was even a worse idea. But Nixon got in, and it's possible that could happen again. Not now, because it's not quite that bad now. But if things increase from the Watts riots were in '64, the national riots, the long hot summer was in 68. So if we see this over the next 4 years, in the 2020 election, we may see a man on a white horse suddenly appear and say, you know, I'll put those animals back in their cages. You just wait and see. Just put me in office and I'll straighten things out. It could happen.
Yeah.
This is the exact kind of situation that does create opportunities for these types. And that is something that of course the leftists never even think about, that they're basically wrecking their own nests, because the first thing that such a guy would go after would be the left, obviously, but it's a possibility that simply doesn't come up, people being short sighted about these kind of things. They don't see it as a trend. They don't see it as something that can go on for years and decades and come out with bad results a while down the road. Everybody's talking about tomorrow, next week. Oh, what do we do? What do we do this summer? Well, it's important, granted, but it's not the most important thing to my mind.
Yeah. Chaz, we got about 5 minutes left here, and I wanted to get in a discussion about, I don't want to say blame, but the responsibility of national leaders on this. I think that the part of President Obama and the Attorney General Eric Holder, while he was in there, has been overblown in this, deliberately, of course, for political reasons. It's understandable. So he's a ripe target. When the president talks about the real problems of policing in black community, people automatically, or at least on our side, automatically assume he's enabling violence. That's not true, and I think even JR would agree with that, or maybe not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But Jazz, what else could the president be doing? I mean, he is the first black president. I mean, what else could he be doing?
Well, I guess we're going to disagree on at least part of that. Neither he nor Eric Holder nor Loretta Lynch, I'm not sure what people think the proper role should be, because what we're talking about is law enforcement. Law enforcement is by nature first a local issue. It is then a state issue. It only becomes a federal issue when you get into certain categories of crime where you need to bring in the FBI and things like that. Nothing going on in Baltimore should be a federal issue. And law enforcement challenges are as unique as the number of communities that there are in the country. Every place is different. Every place requires its own solution. And if you did not have incompetent people in charge, it really should be mayors in cities, it should be governors of states, who hopefully rose up from those communities, who know all the players involved. They have to be the ones making those decisions. When you get somebody jumping the line and going from a situation that originally should have been dealt with by the county, at the county level, by the sheriff's office, and suddenly the Attorney General of the United States is coming in and doing TV appearances and ginning everybody up and saying, well, you're wrong about this, and this should be this way, and, you know, we're going to be checking you out and all that. Well, I don't see how that's helpful, A, and I don't see how it's appropriate, B. You can ask for help from above, but each level should not be sticking their beak in until there is no other choice and until they are invited. But we've nationalized everything, goes back to the media. And so you expect suddenly the first black president and the first female black attorney general, well, why aren't you out there making a statement? Why aren't you sending people? Why aren't you investigating? Well, because it's not really their job. If they're asked for help, they should be prepared to give it in a legal fashion. But these have to be tackled locally. And so, yeah, we're expecting too much when we say that. But also, you know, maybe there's a time to just say, our thoughts are with the people of the city, and keep your mouth shut until somebody asks you.
I agree with that. In fact, if you recall the Trayvon Martin case, JR, where, Holder and the entire Justice Department shouldered their way into this incident, we're going to do an autopsy. So they did an autopsy, and guess what? It exactly matched the autopsy of the coroner. I mean,
exactly.
Henry
Gates too. Look at how Obama muscled his way into the Henry Louis Gates case. He had no business doing that.
I think that's
there's such a thing as vision. I mean, we shouldn't get bogged down in policy. There's such a thing as vision too, and Obama has really showed himself as being the Democratic version of Bush Sr. He has no vision. If he'd gotten in there and started quoting Martin Luther King and started saying, "Let's make the dream real," that would have been another story. Instead, he came in, ditched around, made snide remarks, stuffed Eric Holder and his coterie of little racists in the Justice Department, and gave them carte blanche. It was hopeless. It was hopeless from the beginning. And there's no way he's going to turn around now, no matter what he says about policing. There's no way he's going to turn around now and make it better, because he's gone too far down that road. If he spent the entire rest of 2 years of his term turning around and trying to come back, he'd never make it.
Yeah, and I'm afraid you're right, and I'm also afraid that at this point we're going to have to say goodbye.
All righty.
Okay,
gentlemen.
My guest this evening, my good friend Jazz Shaw. Jazz, excellent, intelligent commentary as always, sir.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it anytime.
Hey, Jazz, good evening.
Okay. And
very
my
nice
colleague day. From American Thinker, editor there, J.R. Dunn, J.R. Catch you on the flip side, buddy.
Righto, Rick. See you in the office.
Take it easy. And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.